This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Box office top 10 this week at 10, Arjunsson.
Yeah, don't know. I'm waiting for reviews from listeners because it wasn't National Press Shown.
At 9, it's The Assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford.
Probably the best
long,
film of the year, and I'm already awaiting people to email in and just correct the fools who've said badly of it.
Well, feel free to email anything that you like. Don't be dictated to by the tyrant opposite.
Now, you know what it is? Most people have seen it. It's so stunned by how good it is that they're not able to pick up their keyboard and text.
The point is that fewer people are going to see that than Good Luck Chuck.
Yeah, well,
that's
just the decline of Western civilization. It's the end of the world as we know it.
The Darjeeling Limited at 7.
Smug, nothing like as funny as it thinks it is, and far too full of its own philosophy.
Ratatouille at 6.
You know, I saw in The Guardian today, they listed that as one of the best movies of the year. That tells you what a poor year it's been. It's a very average film, but the short film at the beginning is funny.
And we see Stardust at 5.
Hasn't Stardust done well? I mean, considering the very, very...
Pat on the back.
Well done. Considering the very lukewarm reviews it got, it's done very, very well. It has continued to, you know, stick it out there in the top 10. I mean, it's a bit raggedy around the edges, but it's good fun and good for it.
Beowulf at 4.
I am Beowulf. I am a Certificate 12 movie, despite the fact that I clearly should be in the 15 certificate.
American Gangster at 3.
Ridley Scott back on form. I mean, it's not The French Connection, but it's punching its weight up there with it. And there's a lot of French Connection in it, and I think he's... When Ridley Scott is good, he's really, really good, and incidentally, everyone's gone to see the Blade Runner thing, well done, because it's, you know, it's back, and boy, is it a great film.
Hitman without her at number 2.
Yes, well, you know, computer games don't make great movies, and the only thing that's more depressing about Hitman is the fact that at number 1 is Fred Claus. So the two movies
that I really hated
from last week have gone at number 1 and number 2, while The Assassination of Jesse James is number 9. I would like every film distributor, incidentally listening, to take note of this. The next time I slag off a film, don't tell me I've done anything damaging to your box office. Demonstrably not.
On the Blade Runner thing,
yep.
Where do you place this version against all the others?
You know, it's funny. There's a kind of miasma of...
You sounded tired.
Not annoyed. It's like one of those things. It's like the three in one. You know, it's like, you know, define the Holy Trinity, all that sort of stuff. There's no answer other than... Because there is something to be said for all the versions. The work print is, in the end, a work print, right? The original version... Are you spilling your coffee all over yourself?
It's just a bit hot.
Okay, the original... It's coffee, Simon. You know, they should put a note on the thing which says, warning, please, you know, it's coffee, it's hot. Duh.
Carry on. Ignore me.
The work print is just a work print. The version with the voiceover is all over the shop, although some people actually have a strange nostalgic fondness for the voiceover. The director's cut was a director's cut, but not quite a director's cut. The final cut is sort of the director's cut with the little mistakes cleaned up. But in the end, whichever version of Blade Runner you watch, you are going to be pretty staggered by it. I mean, a friend of mine said that somebody said to them the other day, I'm just going to see Blade Runner, the final cut, and I've never seen the film before. And this person, Nigel, said... I'm so envious of you to be able to see Blade Runner for the first time and in the correct version. I mean, how wonderful to be able to walk into it for the first time in the proper version. Because the rest of us have kind of got to this version via so many other different versions. It's like, you know, you keep digging away, you keep digging away, you keep digging away. And they're finally, Tutankhamun, where have you been? You know, so that's what it's like. I think the new version is pretty spectacular, but... I think all the versions have a validity in some bizarre way.
This from Andrew says, went to see Blade Runner with my girlfriend Tracy the other night. Halfway through the movie, I pointed out that Harrison Ford's eyes had an orange tint in them.
Well, that's in the new version.
Well, clearly, she's just gone the other day, so they've gone to see the new version. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. No, beg your pardon. Yeah, okay.
I went to see Blade Runner with my girlfriend Tracy
the other night.
That's the key bit.
Okay.
Halfway through the movie, I pointed out Harrison Ford's eyes had an orange tint in them. She asked, what does that mean? He's a replicant, I said.
He is.
She looked shocked. Then she looked angry. Then she elbowed me in the ribs and said, no, he isn't. You can't argue with logic like that. So we can put to rest the question over whether Deckard is a replicant.
Well, I can give you chapter and verse on this because, as you know, my documentary on the edge of Blade Runner, which isn't on the new box set.
How disappointing that must be for you.
The fans are crushed. Was the first place that Ridley Scott ever said in public, he's a replicant. Of course, the interesting thing about Ridley Scott saying he's a replicant was Harrison Ford, who plays him, didn't think he was a replicant. And there's a lovely, and this is the truth of where the Deckard is a replicant thing comes from. It came from a misunderstanding in the script between Hampton Fancher and David Webb Peebles, right? They were writing the script separately, working on it separately, and at one point sort of quite rivalrously, but then end up coming together. And at one point, one of them, and I think it was Hampton Fancher, had written a line in which Deckard is wondering about human beings being the people that built the replicants, right? You know, they built the replicants, therefore they have a godlike relationship to the replicants. And yeah. Deckard then says...
Is there much more of this?
Yes, no. Okay. And Deckard then says, and I wondered, what about him who made me? And Fancher meant it as, what about God? But David Webb Peebles read it and went, brilliant! Deckard's a replicant! And Hampton Fancher went, is he? And David Webb Peebles said, yeah, it's in your script! And Hampton said, yeah! Great idea. That's where the Deckard is a replicant thing comes from a misunderstanding. And of course, he is. And then, as Ridley Scott said, he's a replicant, except if you're Harrison Ford, in which case he isn't.
A bit niche.
You
that.
Brought it up.
I know. I didn't realise
so
the answer was going to be
The Wicker
quite...
Man and Blade Runner. You'll be doing the big E word next, and we'll never That's get anything true. Reviewed.
Okay, so just to. We need to squeeze a quickie in before the
we
news.
Can't do Silent Night as a quickie, so I can do.
Okay. Well, let's just take the news as it's half past.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, Adele. Jesse James is wonderful. The
Thank
other people
you.
Are just plain wrong. Hope
yes.
you're well, Simon.
Thank you very much. And Mark.
That flooded in from a sycophant. No, it's not Mark. Actually, just says... Oh, just say Kermode is right at the
yeah,
top.
Okay, great, fine.
And then says, hope you're well, Simon. So,
thank you.
Anyway, so thank... that is...
That's the silent majority
that's
speaking.
That's done. Next Thursday on the programme, we're looking at children's and young people's books in our books panel. We're looking at Iron Hand by Charlie Fletcher. It's a follow-up to his book, Stoneheart. This is sort of pitched at 8 to 12-year-olds. Also reading... The first children's book that Philip Pullman wrote, Count Carlstein, which has just been re-released. This is kind of 10 years and above. If you'd like to be a listener reviewer for either of those books, email me, mayo@bbc.co.uk. Text 85058. We'll send you a copy of the book. You read it. Talk to us next Thursday. Speaking of Philip Pullman, this email says, is from NIDA, says, as a huge Philip Pullman trilogy fan, I was giddy with anticipation about The Golden Compass on Wednesday night. 2 hours later, my mood had altered. The original story is so good that it sustains the film to an extent, but it is stodgily directed, saddled with a screenplay that insists on explaining every single concept to the audience five times over. Characterization is non-existent, and the whole thing feels like a Boxing Day TV production. If Mark doesn't make some sort of comment about the bit at the end where a character asks, can we go to sleep now? Then he's clearly losing his touch. Mark Kermode on The Golden Compass.
Well, firstly, hello to Jason Isaacs, because...
Should he be in this?
According to the IMDb, he was Philip Pullman's first choice for one of the roles, but sadly...
Do we
not
say hello to him now, by the way?
That's what I just said.
Yeah, well,
sorry.
Didn't leave a space for him to say hello back.
Okay, so together, hello Jason
Hi,
Isaacs.
Jason. There you go.
And
David
Morrissey.
Can he be in this? Is he in there?
I don't think he was in the frame, but obviously he could have been in it. He could have been one of the polar bears, and he always would have brought some class to the production, which I think it needed. So, look, long-awaited adaptation of the Philip Pullman trilogy. As said, there's no point in attempting to do a plot synopsis because it's very complicated. All you really need to say is alternative universe, young heroine Lyra Balakwa heading off in search of lost children who are the centre of a plot which is separating children from their demons. In this alternate world, everyone has a demon. Which follows with them. The demon is not bad as we think of in our world, but it is more of a familiar. It is basically part of their soul. And in the course of doing this, she is taken under the wing of Marisa Coulter, played in Ice Queen fashion by Nicole Kidman.
Lara, my dear, the tutor of metaphysics tells me that you've missed your lesson again. Now, I know you do not always understand our need to educate you. Sometimes you must do what others think best.
But I disagree, Master.
Mrs. Coulter.
When I was a young woman, I knew that no one could ever really truly understand me. Except, of course, my demon. And that it would be best if we were free to do as we pleased. Sit down, gentlemen.
Who's she?
Dunno. But she shut up the Master, all right.
So, I never read the Philip Pullman novels, but I saw the...
Well, there you go. Well,
no,
stop
on.
Right there.
No, no, no. Why?
Because that sets you apart.
Okay, fine. So, Silent Light is the new film by Carlos Reguera. No, look, okay, let me finish that sentence. I've never read the Philip Pullman novels, as I will admit, frankly. I have seen the play, At the Nash, darling. And it was the two plays, wasn't it? It went on for most of the day. And when I saw the play, having not read the novels, there were two things that really impressed me. The first thing was that the story, as described by the play, which I think is probably fairly close to the book, is very theologically or philosophically dense. I mean, it's an extraordinary work. It talks about alternative universes, talks about religion, talks about freedom, talks about ideas of original sin, talks about the junction between this world and the next, and ends with God himself coming on stage in what looks like a glass coffin, in a way which many people have, you know, interpreted as profoundly anti-religion, which is obviously giving the heebie-jeebies to the film producers.
I think it's a question of interpretation. I think it's quite clearly
fine. Okay, great. So this is obviously something that worried New Line, but I was very, very impressed that along with me and, you know, people like Mark Lawson, you know, the elder generation, there were 10, 11, 12 year olds.
He listens every week as well.
Hello, Mark Lawson, Mark. Who also should have had a role in the film, sitting there watching the play and clearly understanding the ideas, because the ideas were being expressed in, I mean, they were complex ideas, but they were being expressed in a manner which was totally understandable. And in fact, I said to a couple of kids who looked very, I said, you know, are you understanding the story? He said, oh yeah, of course, we've read all the books, we know how it works, and this, that, and the other. And that really impressed me. The other thing about it was that the story involves these demons. Every character has a demon which takes the form of an animal. When you're a child, it can change, and then at some point it fixes. And there's also, there's polar bears, armed polar bears, and the way these were done on stage was the demons were done with people holding puppets, people dressed in black holding little puppets, and the polar bears were sort of suggestive suits, you know, people wearing suits with a head over there and a paw there, so one hand and head, rather than people actually literally looking like polar bears. Incredibly evocative, really, really magical, really dense, really rich. All of these things are absent from the film. As far as the magic is concerned, there's CGI everywhere. I mean, you actually have the armed polar bears, because in these days, that's what you can do. And yet, sorely lacking the magic of that stage production, of the magic, the sort of imaginative magic. Secondly, theology is not in it. I mean, there is an awful lot of plot in The Golden Compass, which, of course, is adapted from The Northern Lights, although The Northern Lights barely feature in it. There's an awful lot of plot, but there's really not much substance whatsoever. Now, the reasons why there's not much substance is it opens debate. Some people say that what happened was that New Line, or the producers of the film, wanted to take out anything that would be seen as being anti-religion, because not only is this post-Lord of the Rings, it's obviously post-Passion, and as we all now know, the Christian buck at the box office is a really big thing. Maybe that's the truth. The other thing is, there are all these stories about Chris White, the director. He was on the project, he was off the project, he was on the project, he was off the project. They all got, you know, heads locked in the editing room. They were trying to wrestle the thing down. In the end, they ended up losing the bit at the end, which might end up going in the next film. Whatever the truth of that is, because you can never trust stuff you read on the internet, it looks like a film that was messed around with in the editing room, and it looks like a film that's kind of botched together, because there's a lot of bits, but what there isn't is any real sense of narrative arc. Characters turn up in the beginning, they disappear, we don't see them again, a little flash at bit later on. There's an awful lot of confusion, and it's about an hour and a quarter before the big fight, the first big bear fight. And in the screening that I saw, the end of the first big bear fight, there was a round of applause, and I felt the round of applause was not so much because the fight was spectacular, but because everyone thought, fine, we finally got off the starting block and something's actually happened. We can understand good bear, bad bear fighting, you know, yeah, one wins, ba-boom, it's actually kicking into gear. Now, I have an overriding problem with all of this, which is that Lord of the Rings, you know, I think was wonderful. And I thought The Chronicles of Narnia was like Lord of the Rings light. And this is not even Narnia. It's been a kind of descending trickle-down effect, because you have to compare this to Lord of the Rings and Narnia, because the film only exists because of Lord of the Rings and Narnia. And clearly, in its substance, in its source material, as I said, only from having seen the plays, on stage in one day, I came out of it thinking, wow, it's unbelievable. I mean, it's, you know, it's really, you know what my religious affiliations are, but I thought it was really, really interesting and intriguing and open-minded and good-hearted and, you know, about something. I mean, really about something. And I came out of the film thinking, it's about an hour and three quarters. There's a wonderful thing in the BBFC judgment on it, which is it's PG rated, and it says the reason it's PG is that it does have a big fight, but it says it's completely bloodless and also fairly brief. And I think that's actually a very good description of the whole film. It is completely bloodless and also fairly brief. I mean, it feels longer than it is, but it's under 2 hours, and it feels like it's had the guts ripped out of it. It's not terrible, and I don't doubt that many kids will enjoy it, partly because it has a very, very feisty heroine character in the young girl's called Dakota Blue Richards. Is that her name?
You're the film critic.
Yeah, no, I know. I've got it written down, but I can't. Anyway, Dakota Blue Richards, that is her name. As everyone keeps saying, it's clearly a country and western star coming back to life. But she's terrific. You know, does a really good job. She's great. Nicole Kidman, I'm not so sent on. Don't believe in her in the Ice Queen way, in the way that I would, for example, have believed in somebody like Sigourney Weaver. But these are minor details. In the end, the problem is, It's just an empty shell of a film. And if you can do all that with all that substance and all that magic and all that otherworldly stuff on stage, Acton Ash, darling, why can't you do it on screen?
Well, the books are sensational. So the first thing that you have to do is, never mind the play, which I saw as well. But
oh, you're fine.
Book.
So you never felt like leaping in and agreeing with me?
No, because there's no point in agreeing with you, is there really? And Timothy Dalton playing Lord Asriel.
That should be on your tombstone. There's no point in agreeing with
well,
you.
Well, there isn't really. Timothy Dalton playing Lord Asriel.
Yes, of course,
on
two
stage,
Bonds.
And then we get a Bond playing.
The Bond, yes.
But if they haven't made
the Lord Asriel was the role that Jason Isaacs apparently was earmarked for.
Well, Jason,
but it's a bit of a thankless task in this one, because in the film he's there in the beginning and then he's off.
I've always thought that the books aren't—they're not for kids. Some of the ideas in there are so profound. I was thinking, I'm struggling here on this one. But if they haven't made the section where the kids are being separated from their demons,
they have made that.
I know. Let me finish a sentence. If they haven't made that
a truly
terrifying moment, how can that be bloodless? That's one of the most scary, terrifying.
Well,
bits in the whole book.
I think in a miraculous departure from form, you've hit the nail right on the head.
Excellent.
Rather than doing your usual straight to the heart of the periphery, you've actually nailed it. Right, that's exactly the point. Thank you, Simon. I have taught you well, and my work here is done.
Thank you. Next week, it's me on my own. So if you're a fan of the books, or if you're a fan of the play, you might be disappointed. But if you're coming this completely cold, not knowing the story,
you won't understand a word of it. Because it doesn't make any sense. But you will think, bunch of fantasy animals. I mean, it's not terrible. It's really not terrible. But an indication of its failings are that I came out of it thinking that The Chronicles of Narnia was a much tougher film than I thought going in.
Justine Green, by the way, one of our newsreading team,
yes,
went to the premiere of the new version of Sleuth. I bring this as a piece of tittle-tattle. Mm. And she was talking to both Kenneth Branagh, darling, and Michael Caine.
Yeah.
And the former was very excited to be getting the occasional, but not yet permanent, hello.
Oh, great.
On Fridays. Michael Caine, intriguingly, had an almost stalker-like level of knowledge about this particular part of the programme. And clearly on that basis deserves at least one hello, do you think?
But he's not Sir, is he? Is he Sir Michael? He should be, clearly. Should we have him as Sir Michael?
I just think he wants to be mentioned.
Okay, hello, Sir Michael Caine. And hello, Kenneth Branagh.
Thank you.
Who I just love.
Anytime they want to appear on the programme, it's fine. Roger, just turn up at reception and demand that you come on. Roger in Angmering, since Mark cruelly dismissed my National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation suggestion the other day...
Yeah, that wasn't cruelly, that was putting it out of its misery kindly.
I now sit adjusting the radio volume down when he starts talking and back up when he stops, which is rarely. If he reconsiders and issues an apology, I may consider resuming normal listening practice.
The only thing that makes Christmas Vacation look less than stinky is if you see European Vacation. And then it's like, oh, blimey, Christmas Vacation was an absolute comic pinnacle, an accessible pinnacle.
You might like to know that Mark Kermode goes mobile, as from this week. You can now hear his thoughts on the UK's top 10 anytime, any place, anywhere. If you have a WAP-enabled phone, you're looking at me, so this is news to you.
You make me sound like a martini.
Text the word mobile to 85058, follow the link that we send you, and then you have Mark coming out. I've got Mark Kermode on the phone. why you'd want that, not sure. No more texts and emails on the Jesse James thing, please.
Are there loads saying it's great?
This text says Stephen Fellows here from the Comsats.
Stephen Fellows!
From the Comsats. It says Jesse James is great, but Joy Division were better than us. That's what it says.
Is that really from Stephen
Fellows?
That's
what it says.
If that really is from Stephen Fellows, Stephen, I've fixed your guitar and it works a treat and I love it.
So no more Jesse. Thank you on that. Also, we know that it was The Pathfinder, which was my lab movie, which I'm now going to try and find out on DVD because it was rather splendid. That being done and sorted. Oh, also, it is Michael Caine without the Sir.
Yes, I know.
But it is Sir Maurice Joseph Micklewhite Jr.,
ah.
So that's where the Sir goes, but as a working name, hello, Michael.
Okay.
On his own, anytime you
want
to come.
And on a technicality, I didn't fix your guitar. Paul fixed your guitar, and
he
did a brilliant job of it. Silent Light, very quickly. Third film from Carlos Regardos. The last film he made was Battle in Heaven, which I really, really hated. I played at the Cannes Film Festival, and everybody applauded it. And it was just a load of old tosh. So I wasn't looking forward to Silent Light at all, which is a 136-minute art house film in which nothing happens quite a lot. And I have to say, I was really won over. Nominated for the Palme d'Or and won the jury prize. It is apparently the first Plautdietsch dialect German language film. It is also Mexico's official official submission for the 80th Academy Awards and the first film from that country that's not in Spanish. The story is basically, try and imagine Witness, but as directed by Ingmar Bergman. It is a love triangle amongst the North Mexican Mennonite community, speaking this dialect, which of course to me sounded Dutch. There is a husband, he is married to his wife, but he is in love with another woman. He is suffering because... obviously, it's a terrible thing. He's being torn apart. She is suffering more because he's doing a terrible thing. The third party is suffering quite a lot. At some point, they go off.
Terrible things?
But yeah, terrible things are happening, and terrible spiritual things are happening. But, as the title suggests, silent light. Not much dialogue. I mean, an awful lot of it is done in silence, and it's to do with glances, it's to do with looks, it's to do with, you know, pictures of people looking and responding, which I have to say often for me is like, yeah, come on, move on with it. But in this case was really rather entrancing. And light opens with what appears to be, but isn't, a real-time sunrise, and closes with the picture fading completely to black. And in the middle of it, you have a portrait of these three people, these... in the middle of this really sort of terrible soul-destroying thing, and as I said, very Bergman-esque, with a little hint of Witness, and occasionally threatens to veer into Lars von Trier territory, although Lars von Trier would have made it a much more cruel film and everybody would have ended up being horribly killed. And it is,
as opposed to being pleasantly killed.
Yeah, and it is a film which ends with something which may be miraculous, depending on how you tend to interpret it. Obviously, the way I am, of course, I see it as miraculous because I'm an optimist. You know, I believe that matter is Lucifer crawling itself back towards God. So what do I know?
You believe that matter is what?
Lucifer crawling itself back towards God. Let's not even get into that because I'm getting called a supporter of intelligent design, which I think I quite specifically said I would never use that term because it has so many associations with nutballs in America.
Sound as though you were, and of course no one would ever think you're a nutball.
No, they wouldn't. Anyway, Silent Light is a really impressive piece of work. It is clearly the film of the week. I'm going to say that now because we'll run out of time. We come up to 4 o'clock. I never thought that I would say that about Carlos Regardez movie because I really hate Battle in Heaven. I thought Battle in Heaven was a really stupid film. My only worry about this was it's been rated 15. And the BBFC say it's been rated 15 because it has a sex scene which is suggestive, but it is clear what's going on. I just wonder about a system in which this is a 15 certificate and Beowulf is a 12. I mean, this is a profound movie and it's about real things and it's about, spirituality and human suffering and in the end possibly transcendence and goodness and forgiveness. And Beowulf is about naked people hitting each other with swords and running off with Angelina Jolie dressed as a lizard. I mean, hey, go figure. You raise the kids in the way you feel appropriate, but it's a 15 certificate movie. So, moving on.
Craig in Cardiff, by the way, just interject as you pause for breath. Mm-hmm. Says, I downloaded last week's podcast. I noticed that you made a terrible mistake.
Oh, go on.
Regarding your top 10 Christmas films.
Yeah.
Details online.
No, this is to do with Scrooge.
Whoa. Can I finish?
Yeah, because you're going Scrooge is
no.
a Christmas carol.
No.
Okay.
I'm not.
Okay.
Blimey. You said that you could never put a Chris Columbus film in your top 10, but I'm afraid you have. Chris Columbus wrote the screenplay to Gremlins. Will it stay in your top 10 now? Oh.
You know,
gotcha.
That's so busted.
Oh. Well done, Craig and Cardiff.
I just say, for the first time in a very long time, I am hoist by my own petard. And worse, I'm speechless.
Let's just enjoy that moment. A lot of people getting very panicky. So,
if you do that for long enough, the emergency transmitter kicks in and it starts playing somebody playing Albatross.
It'll probably be Eddie Mayer doing
it. Who was that who wrote that in?
That's Craig in Cardiff.
I think he gets a special prize.
Okay, he's one of many, but anyway, he might get a special Five Live prize, if there is such a thing, but there isn't, of course, anymore, because we don't do prizes.
Okay.
Feel free to fill in the next 5 minutes with any reviews you have handy.
Very quickly, Southland Tales, which is the new movie by... New movie by the guy who made Donnie Darko, right? Richard Kelly. He made Donnie Darko, great. He then did the director's cut of Donnie Darko. Oh, dropped the ball there, rather. He was then involved with Domino. Terrible, terrible, terrible. Then, Southland Tales, 2006, Cannes Film Festival. The first screening of Southland Tales, a post-apocalyptic vision of LA, I think it's 2008, starring The Rock as somebody, The Rock, but he's not called The Rock anymore, he's called Dwayne. The Rock, and he's been abducted, but he's come back and he's got amnesia, but he's got a movie script which is about a cop who may not be a cop. And then Sarah Michelle Gellar, her out of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, she's a porn star called Krista Now, and she does a reality television show that's also vaguely political, and there's some terrorist stuff going on, and there's that guy who's Stifler out of the American Pie movies, and he's two cops, and if they meet and they shake hands, the whole world will let, and this, blah, 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 and it goes on and on and on. We're all sitting there going, this is the worst film ever to be nominated for the Palme d'Or, possibly the worst film ever. We come out of the screening and people say, what do you think? So one thing you can be guaranteed about it, you'll never see it in that version again because it's so monumentally terrible. We were right. He's now spent the last 18 months completely re-editing it, came out again, different version. You know what stinks just as much second time around? Absolutely terrible. It's like one of those things when... Do you remember that band The Vapors?
Yes, in fact,
Turning
I even
Japanese.
Saw them.
Oh, did you? Great. Yes. Turning Japanese, great pop song. Right? And then
no
what?
No sex, no drugs, no wine, no women, no fun, no sin, no you,
no wonder it's dark. That shows
man.
Our age.
Oh, dear.
Right? But then, great, great, great pop record, right? Yes. But then, what after that? News at 10? And then, what happened after that?
They did a record about that Jim Jones.
No, gone. See? Okay, fine.
The mass killing.
Okay, fine. All good. No, you're thinking of looking through Gary Gilmore's eyes by the adverts.
No, I'm not.
Okay, fine. Well, I was only bringing it up as a passing thing to say it's possible to have one great thing in you, or the wonders in that movie, That Thing You Do. Richard Kelly is like the wonders. One great record followed by absolutely nothing afterwards. And in the case of this, the Southland Tales, I mean, it's appalling. It's genuinely appalling. I've seen it twice. Don't understand a word of it. It's taken up 5 hours of my life. Not interested. Don't care. It is like being in a room with a bunch of stone people going, and then, man, you know, The Rock comes up and he's great because he's like two people, but he's only one person. And Sarah Michelle Gellar, she's in Buffy, but she's a porn star. Yeah, fine. Don't care. So, moving swiftly on, You Kill Me, the new film from John Dahl. Remember John Dahl? On the subject of careers, what have gone like this, right? John Dahl.
And what is this for the radio
going
audience
down,
as opposed to me?
Yes, going from...
The only other one I can see.
Sorry, but I only have eyes for you. The career going on a downward... Going up, right? So he did Red Rock West. Well, he did Kill Me Again. Then he did Red Rock West. Then he did The Last Seduction. But Red Rock West came out after The Last Seduction. It was re-released because Last Seduction was a great big sort of hit movie and everybody really, really loved it. Then he made a movie called Unforgettable, which predictably was rather forgettable. We probably haven't got time for a clip of this, but the story is Ben Kingsley is a hitman, right? But he's got an alcohol problem. He's got personal problems. So he gets sent to Alcoholics Anonymous so that he can overcome his personal problems and become rehabilitated as a hitman. Now, forgive me for saying this. Mobster with personal problems. That would be The Sopranos, wouldn't it? Or it would be Analyze That. Or hitman who's in a domestic setting and a young woman falls in love with him. She kind of, you know, responds to the craft of what he's doing. That would be The Whole Nine Yards, wouldn't it? And its sequel, The Whole 10 Yards. Now, in their defense, the screenwriters of this film apparently wrote the screenplay 8 years ago. And it's possible that if I'd seen it at the end of the 90s, you know, you might have thought, well, quirky, interesting idea. We are now in an age in which even I have seen the box set of 6 Feet Under. So it's like, it's not just that you missed the train, it's that people have come and taken up the railroad tracks and are building an airport over it. I mean, there, you know, it's, you are so after the fact. Plus, Ben Kingsley is doing an accent. I believe the accent to be Polish. When he's good,
he's
really
very
good.
He's very, very good.
And when he's bad,
he's Gandhi.
And there
Which
is
I don't agree with. I'm
a
just
touch
repeating.
Of the Gandhis in this, although I think Gandhi wasn't quite so Polish.
What
as
about
this.
The Hood? Was he better as the Hood in Thunderbirds?
Actually, I quite like him as the Hood in Thunderbirds. But then again, he's just doing a non-specific sort of wicked accent. I mean, You Kill Me is not a terrible film by any means. It's quite nicely written. It's dryly directed. And there are a couple of, you know, a couple of good gags. But it just feels terribly after the fact. And if even I know it's after the fact in terms of its sort of television references, then it is really after the fact. It's, you know, it's this... You've missed the boat majorly.
Can you just clear one thing up? If people are considering going to see He Was a Quiet Man...
He Was a Quiet Man.
That's not an Ian Duncan Smith biopic, is it?
No. And it's nor is it a remake of the John Wayne film. I would have talked about that and the killing of John Lennon together, but unfortunately we've run out of time.
If only Drive would give us 5 minutes, but
yes.
I don't think
it was all
like
it would
that.
Take.
Movie
just
of the
five
week.
Minutes. Silent Light, the new film by Carlos Regardas.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.